Greetings and welcome to Telling Tales and our second show of 2026. Who else but Mike to lead us off?
Hello once again, this is Michael Jones with a new story, Operation Valletta. The flight took off from the south of England and climbed into the air to reach its optimum height and cruising speed over the Channel. On board, towards the front of the plane, there was a middle-aged man on his way to the island of Malta. He had all sorts of reasons for travelling, journalism and photography, for instance, but not least amongst these, the urge to see foreign countries. They released their safety belts and relaxed as the flight progressed. 3.5 hours passed slowly and the passengers made polite conversation above the clouds as time passed interminably. The traveller felt a sense of mortality at 30,000 feet as he looked down from the window of the plane upon the landscapes of continental Europe. They hit turbulence as they crossed the Mediterranean, and strangely they flew out of the daylight and into the night, through climate chaos and September storms, with electric lightning flashing over the fuselage of the plane. Lucca Airport awaited them. Fortunately, it was a safe landing, and soon they were taxiing towards the terminal building to disembark and eventually join the crowds at customs and passport control. Valletta was still busy, even at this time in the darkness of the night and the lateness of the hour. The journalist managed to flag down a cab and his arrival was anticipated at a hotel reception desk a few miles across town. He spent the night perspiring in an unfamiliar hotel room with a balcony overlooking one of the side streets. He barely got a few hours sleep before waking at dawn to the sound of the air conditioning whirring away continuously and the guests gradually coming to life downstairs. He showered and joined them for breakfast before venturing out into the narrow alleyways of the Maltese capital, already saturated with people. He discovered English in all areas, with a dash of Italian amongst the spoken words of the population. There were tanned faces on all sides in the cafes and stores which lined every avenue in the city. He loved the fountain squares where the crowds gathered in the intense heat, and the kids ran around in the shadows cast by the great hotels and the palm trees which stood guard out in the road. He reached the Grand Harbour on foot and casually lit up a cigarette when no one was looking. Gazing across the historic waterway, he could see the ferries leaving port and the motor yachts quietly at anchor. He saw the police boats manoeuvring in the bay, intercepting craft as they entered Maltese waters, maybe to board and search the vessel or simply to caution the sailing community. He felt a sense of trauma as they went through their procedures, though the signal's battery remained silent in the park, and no gun was fired in anger. The light hit the water and he walked away in the direction of the cathedral, ascending the steps and entering through the side door. He felt his religion returning to him as he looked upon the altar and the sacraments, the icons and the artwork that graced the walls of the building. There was a silence here that came from the faith and the ancient atmosphere built out of granite centuries ago. He left inspired and enlightened by the experience and thought for a long while as he rejoined the people out in the street as to who he really was and which direction his life was to take. Back in England, a woman in a convertible was waiting for him at the airport. He clattered down the steps of the plane and threaded his way through arrivals and departures to exit into the cold British weather. He drove him away with a smile. "Good trip," she asked him as the car gathered speed. "It was okay," he replied. "We went through turbulence, thunderstorm, 90-degree heat. Well, you can imagine, I saw a police operation out in the harbour. I don't quite know what happened there." "Sounds like Operation Valletta or something," she said with a sense of humour. "It wasn't quite as dramatic as that," he replied, laughing. They drove on into the afternoon through the rain and the traffic, and on to their uneventful home in the suburbs, where they talked late into the evening about his journey to Malta.
Thank you, Mike. And next, from Steve Reynolds, we have quite a sombre tale.
Empty chairs. When the package arrived, Mary knew immediately what it was. She put it on the hall table unopened and left it there, where it remained untouched for a month. But every time Mary went in or out of the house, the package nagged at her like a grumbling toothache. She knew that she would have to deal with it eventually, but like a trip to the dentist, she couldn't help herself in delaying as long as possible. Then she received a text message from her brother asking if she would like to go to his house for Christmas. Once there, he would undoubtedly ask her about the book, so finally she gave in and opened the package. Turning to page 27, she stared at the image. The day the photograph had been taken was a blur in her mind. She'd resisted the idea for so long that when she finally gave in to the pressure from her brother, she hadn't been prepared for what had happened. Standing in that room with all her extended family behind a white plastic chair had seemed surreal. Four generations of the family all together for the first time for such a strange purpose. When her brother had first told her of the plan for the photograph, she couldn't decide if he was joking or had lost his mind. Empty Chairs was the title of the book. It was a series of photographs of an extended family standing behind a chair left empty to represent a person lost to them, each for a different reason. A child from Abovan, a soldier who died in Afghanistan, a woman drowned on the Herald of Free Enterprise, a man on his first day at work in the Twin Towers, a concert goer at the Bataclan, a passenger on Pan Am Flight 103, a farmer who'd lost his herd to BSE, a teenage joyrider, an 8-year-old who loved Ariana Grande, a boy stabbed in a school playground, and so the list went on. Was it supposed to be a demonstration of the randomness of death or the futility of life? She had no idea. Her family's contribution was that Mary's father had been the last man to hang in England in August 1964. How could anyone tell what Mary had gone through by looking at that photo? 10 years old and having to move away from everything she had ever known, having to use a new name and pretending that her father had died in a road accident. Every day she'd woken up shaking with fright that somebody would guess her guilty secret. It might have been 61 years ago, but the shame of her father being a convicted murderer had never left her. Her brother kept on about getting a posthumous pardon, but that was just pie in the sky. The photo had been a mistake. Nothing had changed, except now the world knew her secret. The last men to be hanged in Britain were Peter Anthony Allen and Gwyn Owen Evans. Both men were executed simultaneously on August the 13th, 1964, for the murder of John Allen West only 4 months before, on the 7th of April, 1964.
Now, Lee, what have you got for us?
Right. A couple of weeks ago, when the wind chill factor was registering -6, I decided to get a haircut and instantly regretted it on stepping back out into the street. This is called winter cut. The air bites first. Cold finds every inch of me. Wind slips frosty fingers into the spaces where hair used to be. Scalp and neck uncovered, slipping past the collar, testing the skin. Ears thinking they were safe. The air surprised to find them undefended. My delicate armour now gone, the world feels sharper. Snowflakes, bold in their touch, land directly from all directions and melt before I can decide if I mind their audacity. But the assailance of hail is bitter, merciless, as if seeking revenge for something outrageous. I feel the chill advancing in my head, penetrating my ears and brain and behind my eyes. And yet, there's a strange freedom in this absence, this bareness, this clarity of shape. I feel its lightness, heightened awareness, my thoughts unburdened, as if winter has cut something loose that wasn't just hair, that asked for no response. And while the season presses in, every gust announces itself, swift, unapologetic. I walk through it unbidden, as if the bravest thing I have ever done. I breathe deeper, nestled anew in hat and scarf, awake to the world, learning respect for winter all over again, patiently waiting regrowth, finding a quiet strength in the harshness. My second poem is one which I have addressed to my brother as if we were both still young. It's called Crumbs. I've been watching you, bro, and I think I understand. Crumbs are precious. Small, but not insignificant. Last fragments of a meal, or cake, or toast, or biscuit. While nobody else appears to be watching, I see you lick a finger and dab the stray crumbs from tabletop or plate. Run your damp finger around the edge to gather up the last. I suppose, how could you let them go free? It appears to me there isn't a crumb you wouldn't finish off. The flake of puff pastry from sausage roll or pasty. The crust of a cardboard baguette. Seeds escaping from a farmhouse loaf. Last nuggets of Reub